My name is Jairus Grove. I'm the director of the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies and also an associate professor of international relations in the Department of Political Science at the University of Hawaii at Manoa.
You know, specifically, I came to you today, referred by Gay Chan,
yes,
about how would you characterize what's going on here?
It's a good question. I think we're seeing two different things happening simultaneously, and it's hard to not treat them together. The first is that we are actually seeing organized hate groups, which are establishing themselves on campus for not the first time, but in a way that is much more aggressive and for which there is overt recruitment of the student body. And at least, you know, I've only been here for almost 7 years, but speaking to Jim and other people who have been here longer, this is pretty unusual for Hawaii. Not that there aren't racial tensions in Hawaii and there haven't been all of these, you know, these sort of bubbling problems under the surface, but we haven't really seen corresponding or parallel hate groups to the mainland really in some ways flourishing in Honolulu. So that's part of that story.
What causes you to say active recruitment? What constitutes that?
Using other student organizations to put out their materials on the first days of semesters, recruiting much in the way that fraternities recruit on campus, setting up tables themselves with their publications, with posters that they've had professionally printed, trying to increase membership, using other outreach efforts on campus that they have membership in, like political campaigns, to use the political campaign as a kind of, I hate to say it, but gateway drug for people they think might be interested, and then trying to radicalize those people into more overt forms of hate activism.
What kind of groups? What groups are these?
I don't like to talk about the groups by name. I'll say that they really thrive on attention. And I think if people do some research, they'll find a lot of them. I can say that they are both national and international groups. So they make, at least with two of the groups, make strong efforts to commit themselves to their solidarity with other chapters and other cells of the organization, both in the mainland and in Canada and in Europe. And so with one of the groups in question, for which we actually intercepted a number of death threats, including the posting of faculty home addresses, office information on hate websites. So I don't know if familiar are with groups like 4chan.
4chan, how do you spell that?
It's the number 4 and then C-H-A-N. So 4chan is, it became very popular in part because it was supposed to provide anonymity to those who were speaking on it. So it's like a chat room, which is as old as the internet. But the goal was that the servers that hosted the chat rooms would clear themselves out regularly, so there would be no sort of lasting. And so it became very famous when the group Anonymous, which was also not really a group, it was just lots of people identifying as Anonymous, were using it as a way to both strategize and discuss. But there's a particularly infamous stream on 4chan called Politically Incorrect, which is used by a lot of neo-Nazi organizations for organization, for discussion, to just joke around. But we were actually informed by someone who was monitoring the website that there was an ongoing stream by neo-Nazis threatening one of our faculty members. And there were several discussions on how to kill the faculty member, how to torture the faculty member, where the faculty member lived, why they deserved this based on their Jewish heritage. These kinds of things, which raised our attention quite a bit, right? It's a rude and rapid wake-up call when you see colleagues who are, you know, people are discussing putting them in the ovens or wearing oven mitts to class to threaten them, or one who suggested bringing a lamp to class and petting the lampshade to remind the faculty member that Jews were turned into lampshades by the Nazis. So that's sort of the extreme version, right? And so we're dealing with those kinds of organizations.
You're talking about that in Hawaii.
Yeah, that was in Hawaii. So that's a that's new to me. I don't think of that kind of explicit neo-Nazi, lauding the accomplishments of Adolf Hitler. That kind of hate group seems somewhat unique to the island. What's interesting about these hate groups is they live two different kinds of identities. So particularly with the groups in Hawaii, their public face is much less violent than the face when they think no one's watching, which is not so unusual. But in particular, we're starting to see this pattern around the United States. So men's rights organizations or far-right organizations who are not explicitly racist or explicitly fascist, who are organized precisely so that they can get permission to do marches, presences on campus or in other official capacities, and they work as a kind of front, to use a very vulgar term, like the mafia use businesses as fronts, for more radical or right-wing fascist organizations. So one of the things we discovered when we got to see the full text of this massive discussion about murdering faculty members was that their official web pages and other things really focused on what I would call the sort of far conservative end of Trump's campaign. So building walls with U.S. and Mexico, making America great again through more economic nationalism, the most openly hostile hostility was towards transgender rights, in part because those rights don't legally exist yet. But you didn't see them talking about anti-Semitism. You didn't see them talking about anti-blackness. Now, you enter into an anonymous 4chan room, and these exact same people who were outed are posting pictures of black children with Photoshop guns to their heads. They're talking about kikes and burning Jews, and we've got to end all the Jews. And there's a very different kind of private discourse and public discourse. And so I think that's also part of the slow learning curve is, you know, we've dealt with people who are on the kind of fringe of the far right for a long time, but there's a huge difference between aggressive immigration policy, which I find morally distasteful but debatable, and thinking that the Holocaust was a good idea and defending slavery as a rational economic system, right? And that line we're finding out is not a difference of constituents or groups. It's a difference of when those groups are in public versus when those groups are organizing. And that was a bit of a shock, I think, to the system. And so that, you know, that we started to put pieces together. You know, we're finding swastikas that are spray painted on things.
Here at UH.
Yes. We've had reports of students being targeted with swastikas off campus. These kinds of things are starting to bubble up to the surface. And now we're realizing, right, that there's an origin to it, right? We just didn't think that these groups were connected, but they actually quite are. So that was the sort of first point, long first point. The second one was that it's happening in an environment where hostile, often aggressive speech is becoming just vastly more common in the classroom. So we are just seeing more students being disruptive in the classroom, asking purposefully offensive questions about the inferiority of minorities, about, you know, needing to kill all Muslims, you know, can we really trust any of them? The kinds of questions where I think students, even if they believed that, would have felt the need to try to ask either, it's hard to be respectful about those kinds of things, but they would have asked a kind of more obtuse version of it. Like, is there something about Islam that's prone to violence, right? They may have said that in the past and they would have asked, right, and raise their hand. Whereas now we're hearing more hateful speech in the classroom.
Really? This is hard to believe.
Oh, yeah, with some regularity.
These are the same, it's the same sampling of students you're getting.
But what was surprising was finding out that many of these complaints that we were hearing from faculty about students were not the same students who were the members of these hate groups. It's sort of a Venn diagram. There is some overlap, but it's not full overlap. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've noticed on campus as I've tried to talk to more faculty members, and I have more faculty members speaking to me, there's a real pattern. The faculty that are being targeted by the hate group and the faculty who are facing more disruptions are pretty uniformly women faculty. They tend to be women of color, overwhelmingly. You know, the one male faculty member who has had this as a recurrent problem also happens to be Jewish. I don't think that's a coincidence, right? So there does also seem to be this kind of normalization of discussing racism as if it's another legitimate position politically, as being a libertarian or a liberal or a conservative, right? As if, right, racism was just sort of this rational, debatable option.
Based on what, though?
On nothing. On just wanting to voice how angry you are that you feel silenced or that your position isn't taken seriously or that you've been ignored. And I do put a lot of the blame on the way that particularly members of the Trump campaign like Steve Bannon courted these kinds of constituencies, right? So when you say nice things about Alex Jones's radio talk show, which regularly espouses racial conspiracy theories, makes innuendos about women and sexual minorities, and you are running fast and loose with how you speak about people who are physically disabled, as Trump did during the campaign, or you are not that careful with how you racialize the problem of immigration, good immigrants and bad immigrants, you change what is acceptable to say out loud. And I think this is where, you know, there's a kind of think piece that's really made the rounds lately of, oh, maybe we were a little too hysterical about Trump. He's horrible, but look what a failure he is. So it's really not as bad as you think. I've seen a bunch of these talks. I've read a bunch of them. And I think that that misses the point. It thinks that the success or failure, as well as the destruction or salve of a president, is what gets passed through Congress. But the reality is presidents also set a national tone. And the fact that Trump hasn't gotten much through Congress hasn't prevented him from very much empowering people for whom white nationalism is an increasingly so-called legitimate political position. And the other thing that's interesting to me is that you can really see the ways that they borrow from other nationalisms that were you know, actually justified because they were on the behalf of oppressed people.
How does that work?
It's funny, but it's the notion of victimization is quite common. And so when you look at these websites and you look at even the discussions that happen, they think in private, you really do hear this sense that if you're a white male, it's harder in this world now, that if you aren't, you know, of a particular minority class, you're going to have trouble getting into colleges because of affirmative action programs. Of course, affirmative action has almost been entirely dismantled, but facts don't matter here. That, you know, there's this right-wing fascist philosopher that was very influential on Steve Bannon during the campaign. His pen name is Mendicius Moldbug. This website called The Red Pill. It's a reference to the movie The Matrix. And in the movie The Matrix, the main character, Neo, is given the choice between a red pill and a blue pill. And the blue pill returns him back to his workaby lifestyle. The red pill lets him see the truth behind everything, which is that robots are using us as batteries. So he sold his philosophy as a red pill. And his red pill was that everything was controlled by what he called the cathedral. It was basically liberal elites, the media, and universities, and that we have some kind of mind control capability, which, by the way, I wish we had. not the mind control part, but I wish universities were as powerful as they think. But they really see the universities as this sort of constricting influence on public debate, because we've made things impossible to say through the violence of political correctness. And so they can't talk about these really important ideas. And that this is their duty, is to bring these important ideas back. And so you ask them what the important ideas are, and they're like, oh, that black people are prone to violence, that women actually are physically inferior, that traditional families where men are dominant of their wives are happier families. And you're like, oh, so you mean the same retrograde ideas that have been disproven through rigorous research, through every attempt at, you know, building better institutions. And they're convinced all the research is, you know, because it's a conspiracy, fabricated, or that there is no basis for egalitarianism, or yada, yada, yada. So, you know, this is a great moment where it seemed like out of the blue when suddenly we're looking at the big tax reform bill and graduate students are mentioned in it. No one cares about graduate students. What are graduate students doing in a tax bill? And that answer is actually quite clear. This was a shout out to these groups that think that we need to really undermine the university. And so if you want to really undermine universities, attack graduate students. And the tax was unbelievable. For some graduate students, it was 170% increase in income tax because it counted the full cost of their tuition as their tax liability, even though they're making no money at all. But if you end graduate students, you end what creates professors. And if you end what creates professors, then you can make a serious dent in institutions that value things like evidence and research and peer review. And it's, you know, it's also not surprising that the Koch brothers, you know, within days of the tax bill started offering grants that they would give, right? They would pay for people to go to graduate school, but they needed to pass a libertarian litmus test. They had to demonstrate their commitment to a certain conservative ideology before they would be allowed to receive the money to go and get higher education. It would sound conspiratorial if it weren't happening so publicly, but there really is a kind of public disdain. And, you know, like all movements, there's a vanguard, and then there's a kind of, right, sort of more moderate middle. And that moderate middle for conservatives is moving further and further right. And that vanguard is starting to look more like these hate groups, right, who are willing to disrupt classes on purpose. Target minority faculty.
I mean, it's only been a
threats.
Year the guy's been in office.
Yeah.
But you've noticed in that year an uptick in these kinds of problems?
Noticed it during the beginning of the campaign. So even before the election. But I think the success of the election, which I don't care what political side of the spectrum you're on, is a historic election in the sense that we've never seen a dominant party lose control of the primary process this significantly, right? The best sort of historical precursor is a lot of people didn't think Obama could beat Hillary Clinton during the primary, but that was not as dramatic as this, right? Obama had a serious profile in politics. He was a brilliant constitutional scholar, right? He had a resume that made him a credible candidate, right? We didn't see a professional politician disrupted by quasi-media personality, right? We can't just look at what is being passed through Congress, what's happening through executive order. There's a tone, right? There's an environment which is created by a president, right? It verifies a culture.
How widespread would you say this sort of under... It's not an undercurrent you're talking about. You're talking about a phenomenon that has been here in society and is now being given license to express itself. How large can you estimate it is nationally and here in Hawaii?
Oh, I think it's hard to estimate numbers. I don't know if you saw the Aziz Ansari... gave a brilliant monologue at the beginning of Saturday Night Live right after Trump was elected. And he had this great moment. He said, you know, I just want to thank all of the closet racists out there for how much work they'd been doing, just like keeping their racism to themselves. You people are national heroes. Because could you go back to doing that? right? You know, and his joke was not really a joke, right? He's scared for the lives of his parents, South Asian Muslims. But that there was a sense that racism was something you were kind of, even if you believed it, you were embarrassed of. Or if you weren't embarrassed of, you were at least not willing to be open. And there was a kind of free speech argument that said, well, that's bad. It would actually be better if we got it all out in the open and then we could debate it and we could make it go away. And I think we're really starting to see the limits of that free marketplace of ideas thesis. That actually having people who had really often violent, disgusting, and hurtful ideas feeling conscientious enough to not say them was really important to everybody else thriving. Building a better world where there'd be fewer and fewer of those people over time. And so, I don't want to say that, I want anyone to live in fear, but I like a world where there's a norm that saying things that make people feel threatened seems not just inappropriate, but prohibitively inappropriate in classrooms, in places of learning, in public, political discourse. And we're losing that. We're losing that quickly. And I think you can see that across the board.
But nobody's been wanting to stand up for civility, if that's what you want to call it. Many years ago in HuffPost, you wrote about how people have got to challenge this in schools, in regular conversation, but it's not happening.
I think if we take civic or civil to mean an aspiration towards a particular kind of political world, where we can all participate, and we can all participate, and we can all present our ideas, even if they're uncomfortable. But that the limit on that is those ideas cannot be that anyone else shouldn't participate. And that's the weird tension. We want people to be able to present uncomfortable ideas. We want people to be able to be disruptive when we're being silent about the wrong things, right? Being silent about slavery was a wrong thing. But the content of those ideas actually matter. And so one of the contradictions of free speech in some ways is we kind of think that all speech should be equal. And the reality is it can't be. Speech that directly threatens people, that says that we should have a political institution that murders people, those ideas do not have the same character and quality to being civic and being civil that ideas like including everyone, irrespective of race, color, creed, religion. And so I think we're in a position where it was easy to just say, oh, we'll let all speech go because we lived in a nice, quiet, liberal society. And now we're in a place where it's going to be more and more important that Americans use not just this universal rule, but political judgment. Is this a good politics? Should this politics thrive? And I think the answer for this kind of right-wing violence is no, it shouldn't thrive. It should feel ashamed. And I think that as academics, I think as activists, I think as citizens, we shouldn't think that shaming people for immoral behavior and action is the same as the state restricting what can be said. And we've tried to make some false equivalence there, that if we're critical of the right, we're silencing them. The entire point of having freedom of expression was to prevent the federal government from coming in and restricting what we could and couldn't say, because we wanted rigorous discourse. We wanted debate. But this is precisely what debate's supposed to do. Now that the federal government gives us the right to debate, it's our job to go in and debate these ideas. And sometimes debating isn't saying, well, let's take it on its own merits. It's saying, well, we already know what the merits of these things are, and there are totalitarian histories of mass genocide and defunct governments that ultimately murdered more of their own people than they did other people, and we should say exactly what they are. And shaming people into having, the sense to not be violent doesn't restrict their free speech, right? It actually makes a space where we can have free speech, and I think that's a real difference. And that nuance doesn't translate well into policy, and it doesn't translate well into law, because it requires the political judgment of every one of us to know when to intervene. But it's where we are. It's what we have to do. And it's going to be hard.
You're a debate guy, and it's as though there could be debate about this, but there really isn't. How do you debate about something like this?
It's more than that. I mean, I can actually have a debate and would have a debate on whether or not authoritarian governments are more effective than democratic governments. Actually a debate in political science. The difference is it's the problem of cynicism. When everybody means what they say, you can have a debate. If you're saying something because you're trying to drop the equivalent of an idea bomb in a classroom to to derail it, or you're trying to make people feel scared. It's not about the content of the statement. It's about what the statement does to the room. Then you're not actually debating. You don't, it's not just that you don't mean what you say. You're not saying something to transmit that meaning. You're saying something in the same way that someone yells fire in a theater to do something. And the difference between meaning something and doing something is actually a really important difference. If you mean something, there's a kind of invitational character, right? You're trying to communicate what you mean because you want the person hearing you to understand you so they can respond to what you mean.
So, like, aren't all Muslims dangerous because their religion espouses violence to
That's not an invitational question. In fact, that's more of a statement than a question. An invitational question is, gosh, could you tell me more about the ways different religions inform people's decisions to use violence? And then we look at whether or not Christianity has informed violence, whether or not Judaism has informed violence, whether or not Buddhism has informed violence, whether or not Islam has informed violence. Even if you asked a version of the question that you just did, which was a statement, actually, not a question, if it was invitational, then the person who asked it would actually be interested to find out, for instance, that Islam isn't statistically more associated with violence. And that, for instance, every religion has been used or put to violence. But if you said that statement not because you wanted an answer, but because you wanted every Muslim person in the room to feel scared, to feel threatened, to feel as if everyone was going to look at them differently because they were part of a group that was associated with violence, then you weren't trying to communicate. You were trying to intimidate. And
you're saying people do that in classes now?
Frequently. We have reports from faculty members that there are students who every single week will raise their hand and say, I don't understand why we can't finish the conversation about why slavery is a more rational economic way to deal with black criminality than affirmative action. And they don't really want to have a debate about that, because if they really wanted to have a debate about that and they did any research, they would find out that even if you didn't care about the morality of slavery, that slavery was a vastly inefficient economic system. It's a large part about why the South lost the Civil War. Further than that, that black criminality has a lot to do with the aftermath of slavery and has to do with the lack of opportunities and, more specifically, the fact that an illegal economy was the only economy available for a large degree of time, right? If there's strict segregation and you're not allowed to have certain jobs, the jobs you're going to do are going to be illegal, just by definition, right? You can't have that kind of rational discussion because they don't want to have that discussion. They want to see the effect of having said this sort of countercultural or politically incorrect thing. And for me, that's not speech. It's sabotage, right? How can we derail the public sphere? How can we make people feel uncomfortable? How can we draw more attention to ourselves? That's not what debate is.
I'm just trying to get the big picture. To what end? Let's see.
Well, I'll say one of the things that we noticed, I spent a long time, I had this 55-page transcript of this supposedly secret discussion of this group.
On
4chan. And one of the things I thought was actually particularly insightful. I was a little surprised at how strategic they were, but they had actually suggested to one another that people take classes on anti-colonialism, on the Hawaiian sovereignty movement, on the histories of genocide, and it suggested that you ask other white members of the class, aren't you tired of always having to be portrayed as the villain? Aren't you sick of hearing that you killed all the Native Americans? And we all know they were savages. And it had a whole list of suggestions of things that you could do to kind of take advantage of the fact that someone might feel excluded or disadvantaged as a way to get them interested in the kind of more overt form of hate. And I think, it's true. Talking about Native American genocide is uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to think that you're the descendants of people who walked into villages and indiscriminately killed women, children, without regard for any basic human dignity. That's also what education is for. Education is to learn uncomfortable histories, learn to take responsibility for where we came from, to suffer through and find a way to take ownership of history rather than to disavow it. And it's not surprising then that some people are going to feel a little depressed when they first find out that, you know, their great-great-great-grandfather, who they have a picture of serving in the Union Army, and so they thought of them as quite a hero because they defeated the South and went on to hunt down people who are Lakota Sioux. You know, like, that's...
How do people make peace with that, ultimately?
We make peace with the fact that history isn't fate, right? History is just where we start. It's not where we end up. I mean, part of the reason why I'm in futures is that I think it's important that history not be in any way a constraint on how much we can accomplish in the not yet, what we can do otherwise. You know, I bear the responsibility of that history, but I'm not constrained by that history. It doesn't mean that I have to go find new villages to indiscriminately kill women and children. It means that I can understand that privilege that I gained from that history, and I can do something valuable, constructive, productive. And more importantly, in many cases, it means I can sit and listen to the voices of the people who survived those things. And I think I bear a responsibility as the, you know, someone who's been quite advantaged by a history of slavery, by a history of genocide, to just understand and know where that history came from. And I think that's what makes us better people, right? That's what liberal arts education is about. It's about having to wrestle with all of those complexities. And even if we go off to be engineers, we go off to be, you know, people in the tech world, then when we're faced as an engineer with making some new weapon, or we're faced as an engineer with whether or not we should have public transportation or self-driving cars, or we're in the tech world and we want to ask some basic questions about whether or not we just designed a new app that makes surveillance easier on groups that are already targeted, we might stop for a second and think about the kind of ethical questions behind the kind of technological and scientific work we do. And so I want to hold on to those things. I want those uncomfortable conversations. But I want to also hold on to the right for faculty members who've trained for decades to learn how to have those uncomfortable conversations, to have the right to say, I don't think what you're doing is communication. I think it's sabotage. I think you're trying to disrupt the class right now. I think... you know, you can't continue to do that. And if we have this narrow interpretation of, or rather overly broad interpretation of free speech that says, no, everyone has a right to their opinion, then you take away the expertise, right? The years of training to say, no one has a right to an opinion in a classroom. You have a right to an argument. But an argument requires a clear claim, requires a warrant or logic for that claim, and it requires evidence of some kind to back that up. Because if it doesn't have all three of those components, we can't debate about it. So the example I used in my class recently was that I was happy to debate anything in class, but that we should understand what anything means. So I said, we can debate over the existence of God if it's a question of whether or not you can mathematically prove God, right? This was a fight that happened in the 18th century in philosophy all the time. What we can't debate about is if you believe in God, because that's a question of faith. None of us have access to your faith. We can't see your faith written down on a sheet of paper. We don't know the algorithm that got you to that faith. We don't know the full history. And more importantly, we can't dispute it, and we shouldn't dispute it. So whether or not you believe in God is not a debate we can have in public. Whether or not you can prove God with science, that is a debate we can have. And the fun part about that debate is, even if we prove that science can't prove God, we didn't disprove God. We just disproved science can't prove God. If we prove science can prove God, you know, like all things in science, we just proved it temporarily until science does something else, right? So making that distinction between opinion as belief and argument as something that's publicly contestable, that's open to research, that everyone has access to so that they can go back and forth, that distinction is important. And again, you know, not to keep harping on our current president, but this is why it's so dangerous when the EPA comes out and says they're not going to look at scientific evidence-based standards for pollution, or you're not allowed to talk about climate change anymore on the basis of science and evidence, or The CDC can't use particular terms because they're considered objectionable, even if they're the appropriate terms, right? If this kind of narrow version of belief overtakes the bare minimum necessities of public debate, then that's it, right? Like, that's the ball game. We can't have public debate anymore.
No, as I said, it's kind of where we are.
Well, I don't think it's where we are. I think that's where we're encroaching.
Do you think there's, on the national level, there could be some people holding back on their criticism of the kind of tenor, tone, and details of some of the rhetoric because they're afraid it might jeopardize our economic system?
That's a good question. I do think... Well, I'll tell you the sort of folklore of liberal and conservative career civil servants. I spent a lot of time at a lot of different kinds of institutional settings that involve everything from four-star generals to people working in nonprofits. And a lot of people talk about the ways in which they fear impeaching Trump because there is this kind of radicalized grassroots hate movement that they would face potentially militia violence, right? We would see violence. Now, I don't think that actually influences whether or not Mueller is going to indict Trump. He will or he won't. I don't know. But I do think that there are increasing number of people who, because they're so afraid that our system is so fragile, they don't want to talk about the rot in public debate. They would rather say, oh, our institutions are fine. This is just an anomaly. It's a bubble, right? We'll get past it. I don't think that's true. And the reason why is because institutions aren't things. They're made up of people, right? They're made up of traditions. And traditions only exist if you constantly reinvent them. And so if we don't take every opportunity for debate as a challenge to make debate better, there's nothing to fall back on, right? So this idea that the institutions are something like a safety net is just not accurate, right? Institutions only work if we're all vigorously exposing that rot and debating it and articulating it and challenging it. And I think, you know, we'll see what the next presidential election cycle looks like. But I think one thing that we are seeing, and it's quite exciting, is the sort of generation after Sanders. We're seeing more people who are academics, more people who are activists, more people who are committed to public debate as teachers, running for city council, running for school board, running for state elections. You know, I think we had three former heavy metal or punk musicians, one of whom was transgender, win office in the last round of elections. That was pretty amazing and exciting. You know, so I do also think there's a kind of call to arms. You know, I was at this event over the weekend with a number of people working on surveillance, and there was someone there from the ACLU, and they pointed out that the size of the ACLU has gone from something like 400,000 to like 1.7 million. That's good news. But it's got to be more than membership, right? It has to be, I think, a kind of change in the culture of contestability. We can give up on being polite without giving up on being civic. And I think that is going to be one of the most essential skills that people can learn in the next 5 to 10 years, how to rigorously take on an idea. But not think that somehow it's, you know, a lot of people that, you know, the old phrase was, the only thing you shouldn't talk about at a dinner party is politics and religion, right? Because you never know where someone falls. That is the only thing we should be talking about at every dinner party, right? If this is cultural politics, if this is bubbling from the ground up, we have to have uncomfortable conversations. But that doesn't mean we have to tolerate or not critique when people try to sabotage those conversations. And that's the balance we have to find. And I think as educators, we have a unique obligation to say that is an unevidenced and that is a violent statement.
Is it provable that that living in a diverse community with where everyone has equal rights is beneficial?
Well, so that's always an interesting question. It depends on what you mean by beneficial. Do you mean the most economic? Well, again, that's hard to say, right? So authoritarian countries can be very successful economically. Are the people actually happy? Are they living to their fullest potential? No. I can imagine societies that are incredibly decentralized, have very little state influence, and are overcome by warlords. So I don't think that there's a perfect mix between central government and the democratic sort of nature of the people. What I do think is true is that you can't have a thriving society if everyone doesn't feel like they can participate in that society. So even in highly homogenous, relatively centralized societies, when they've worked, it's because there's been actually extraordinarily strong commitment from top to bottom. When democratic societies work, it's because there's extraordinary involvement from top to bottom.
No, we don't have that.
I think we're starting to see a bit of a hollowing out. You know, there's a famous political scientist, spent the end of his life at Princeton, named Sheldon Wolin, and he called it inverted totalitarianism. He said the United States was experiencing a case of inverted totalitarianism, where it wasn't being imposed from the top, it was being imposed from the bottom. That we had more and more corporate control of politics, and corporations aren't run like democracies. They're run like authoritarian states. We have more and more people who thought they preferred things being done for them rather than having to participate politically. And the problem with inverted totalitarianism is it can really sneak up on you because your leaders are still saying the same things they've always said, and it looks very similar. But the culture of the country starts to shift, which means, again, Trump isn't the problem, right? Trump sets a tone, and that's really dangerous. But the problem is that tone resonates with a number of people who I think are less and less convinced that democracy is a thriving way to live one's life. And so, again, that's where we have to defend again. We have to defend democracy again. We can't take it for granted, as we did for a long time, that, oh, well, we're all Democrats here, right? You might be a Republican, I may be a, you know, a big D Democrat, but we all believe in democracy. I think that idea of a consensus, we have to get over very quickly, and we have to build it again, right? A consensus has to be built. It's not a safety net, right? It's a responsibility, and every generation has to repeat that responsibility or it disappears.
Would you ever have an Alexa in your home?
No, but I also don't have a TV in my home. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a good question. It's not because I'm paranoid. I mean, it is true that every international spy agency can hack just about every network device, and they do regularly. It's not just the NSA. It's everybody else's governments, too. But for me, it's more that I like that my home is a space that I come home to with my kids and my partner, and it's quiet until we fill it with noise. I don't like the idea of this just sort of instant and expected connection to everything else. I obviously keep up with international political events. That's what I do for a living. But I don't want my phone dinging all night long every time there's an update about the North Korea crisis. That crisis is going to be the same in the morning as it was at 2 a.m. And I really do believe that these kind of ubiquitous, always on, always interactive technologies are making us anxious in a way, which I think is contributing to this withdrawal from the public sphere. People feel overwhelmed. People feel exhausted. You know, when Trump does something that's objectionable, like the travel ban, you don't hear about it once. You hear about it 1,000 times. And the reality is the impact that has on your body, on your just well-being, is it builds. It builds over and over again. And I think you can hear it. You hear about people feeling anxious. You know, there's a joke about the new Diagnostic Statistic Manual, which is the big book that doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists have to diagnose mental disorders. And when they were making the new draft of it, there was a proposal to have an obsessive-compulsive disorder that was hallucinating that your phone is vibrating. because so many people were reporting it. But the reason they couldn't include it, according to the joke, is not because it wasn't a real disorder, but because to be a disorder, it has to be a pathology, meaning a small percentage of people have to suffer from it. But so many people hallucinate that their phone is ringing or vibrating that they couldn't call it a disorder. It's just a new modern condition. And that's a little sad to me. It's a little sad to me that even when their phones aren't in their pockets, they've become so trained by the ubiquity of these devices that they quite literally can't turn them off, right? That even when they're off, their body is still on. And I think we should be able to carve out a space, right? Of not privacy just in the legal sense, but of intimacy, of quiet, of, you know, relaxation, right? You know, people call it self-care. I don't think it's self-care. I think it's just life. We have to have something of our own. And I think, you know, I'm a futurist, so I'll make at least one prediction. I think in 50 years, we'll look back on the ubiquity of many of these technologies, the way that we now look back on the industrial pollution after the Industrial Revolution in London, where people were coming home and wiping the soot off their face because the air quality was so bad. That we definitely do not have a healthy relationship right now with being fully connected all the time. And we're certainly not seeing the, you know, everybody thought the internet was going to mean instantaneous direct democracy. And the internet has made it, for the same reason the internet would make democracy easier, it also makes other forms of collective action easier. It makes it easier for hate groups to organize around the world. It makes it easier to harass teenagers about their weight without doing it in front of their teachers. It makes it easier to stalk people and commit crimes, right? These technologies are not neutral. And I think it's really time to start having a conversation about that, about whether or not more is not better. Faster is not preferable. And it goes back to your question, you know, can you have a better society without democracy? Well, it depends on what you mean by better. We don't have the conversation about better anymore. So maybe slower internet would be better, even though the measurement would say it was not as fast. Maybe less internet would be better, even though, right, more is more economically productive. You know, as much as we need a debate over civic virtue and public debate, we also need a debate over what the good is that we're striving towards together, right? We're an associational species. We live in groups. And once we live in groups, we want that group to be better. And better isn't more. And that's a hard thing to articulate in contemporary politics. So no Alexa.
What kinds of, what have these threats against teachers and so on been brought to the, to who have they been taken to in terms of security on campus?
Everyone.
Like, who's that?
Security, Honolulu Police Department, the administration. I think the administration's working very hard to figure out what to do about this. I think there are two problems. One problem is, it's actually a hard problem. We want open debate. We want a thriving culture of criticism. I think from a faculty perspective, for me, I want that to be indisputable on the quad. I want it to be under the careful, you know, developed, nuanced authority of a faculty member inside of a classroom. There's a reason why there's faculty and students. Otherwise, students would just get together and teach themselves. But that's a hard balance, right? Where does the public space end? Where does the classroom begin? And vice versa. The second part of it is, and you know, I'm really an outsider. I've only been here 7 years. I don't know this place, but I've made a home here. And Hawaii has a very, very different racial history than the mainland. In some ways, it's both more negotiable and more complex. On the mainland, if you live in the South, it's Latino versus white in the Southwest. It's black versus white in the deep South. It's black versus white in the North. And there's a couple of places you might get both. You know, I mean, here it's six or seven different traditions of immigration, of settlement, of colonial history, of plantation history. And, you know, people in Hawaii are incredibly adept at learning how to communicate and negotiate about that. And they're not necessarily great at it, but I think they're getting better at it. And there's a language here for talking about it. There's also a kind of sometimes casual racism, which I was found shocking. And then I realized, oh, these people are like family-in-law, so they're ribbing each other because they're married. You know, it was you know, it's like hard from an outsider perspective to see it happening. But I think as a result, a lot of people were somewhat complacent that other sort of history of racism and the pitch, right? That like violent pitch of discourse couldn't travel here. That somehow we were too far, we were immune. If it got here, it'd get here slowly. For the same reason we don't need so many Alexas in so many rooms, the interconnectivity of the world means it got here very quickly. It got here, honestly, just as fast as it got everywhere else. It may not be as big as it is everywhere else, but it's big enough to be a problem. And so I think for a lot of people, they just feel caught off guard. And you combine a really hard problem with not being prepared for it, and therefore not wanting to admit that it's a problem, and you get a much harder problem. And so I just think we have a lot of work to do. And what'll make it hard is that we'll have a lot of people who don't want the work to get done, that would prefer that it not happen, right? That we not make progress. And that's where it gets hard. If what you want to do is disrupt, what you want to do is sow dissension and anger and resentment, then you don't commit yourself to how to build a better public sphere. And so the question will be how well we can balance that. And the measure will be how comfortable and confident students feel fully participating in class and not worried about reprisals when they go home or being threatened or being humiliated. And that'll be the task. And that's the task that's before us.
Maybe a handful of teachers are, professors are affected by this? 2? 5?
25. And I would guess that if we're working on a survey, I would guess if you asked everyone, they would all, an overwhelming majority would say that they can feel the difference in conversation in their classrooms, that there's an intensity difference. It was telling to me that one of the people who spoke to me early on was an engineer. Mm. They were like, I was like, really?
How did that come up?
Because he works on renewable energy. And if you can believe it, you can't talk about renewable energy, even in its most scientific and technical character, without it raising political questions. Because we have politicized knowledge, which is not the same thing as politics. We've turned something which can be contested scientifically into something that no longer needs to be contested scientifically because we can dismiss it ideologically. Climate change isn't real. Why should we bother? Are you saying climate change is real when you're saying that renewable energy is important? Right. So we have these major initiatives on campus, like environmental sustainability, like being a Hawaiian place of learning, advancing agricultural adaptation to climate change, right? We have all these issues which we thought of as sort of on their own grounds being legitimate, but now they're caught up in this, you know, next front of the culture war where we have to argue with people about, is climate change real? Is equality and representation of dispossessed and excluded groups a good thing? We thought the fight was just, have we done enough of it or not? And now the fight is, should we be doing it at all? And I think that's something that people weren't ready for. And that's what we have to get ready for. And that's also what we have to help and mentor the next generation of students to be prepared for. That they have to have those skills if we're going to maintain a vigorous democracy.
Oh my gosh, you're talking about specific facts and refutable arguments and stuff like that.
I mean, evidence, the very concept of evidence is under attack right now. There have been all these studies done on how many times has Trump lied, how many times has he used facts that were incorrect, and, you know, the numbers are astronomical. And the response and the corrections are never, oh, this is an update. What he meant to say was. They were, well, what do you mean by that, a fact? You know, like there's literally an open debate right now about facts. And so, like, we have to think about the kind of damage that does to a very sort of necessary precondition to having a public, which is that there are things which we don't own, which all of us can have access to, right? That's what evidence is, right? Evidence, when we have arguments, are things that you don't have to have been the personal witness of in order to dispute. And more to the point, that if you dispute them, that dispute mattered, right? If you disprove something, you have actually disproven it. But if the other side's willing to say, well, it's a post-truth world. Sorry, your dispute is part of the cathedral. It's just the same way that science manufactures evidence. Then where do you go next, right? That's not a debate, right? That's not communication. It's, you know... There's a famous philosopher, he's Austrian, worked in England, named Wittgenstein. He called them language games. He said that every language game has a deep grammar, meaning rules that underwrite the ability for two people to participate in that game. The reality is, when you're working with somebody else who either is purposely sabotaging the rules or doesn't share those basic rules, you're not playing the same game. And if you can't share that most basic feature of communication, then what is ethics, morality, politics? What do those things even mean, right? Responsibility contains the word response. It's that there's a call and response to responsibility. To be responsible to someone else is to hear their call. And if you can't even hear them because their language doesn't overlap with yours, you're cutting yourself off. And once that cut happens, we don't share a world, then the kinds of dehumanization that leads to violence, right? The kinds of dehumanization that thinks certain people aren't human, the kinds of dehumanization that thinks that some people are inferior, it thrives. Because how would that person ever assert their humanity if it weren't for being able to communicate it, right? So sabotaging communication isn't like sabotaging the power or standing in the way of traffic. It's literally sabotaging what makes it possible for us to live together. And so for me, that means that it's literally the most important thing that we could be talking about.